welcome to A Bookish Home. I'm Laura Zara-Popinski. This week, I'm delighted to share an interview with Crystal King, author of the new book, The Chef's Secret. Crystal is a novelist, editor, professor, social media professional, and critical and creative thinker. Her debut novel was called Feast of Sorrow, which was about the man whose name is on the world's oldest known cookbook. Crystal has taught writing, creativity, and social media at UMass Boston, Boston University, Mass College of Art, and Harvard Extension School. She also teaches classes on social media for authors at Grub Street, a wonderful writing community here in Boston. Crystal King, welcome to A Bookish Home. I'm so excited to have you on.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
So your new book is called The Chef's Secret, and it centers on a chef working at the Vatican during the Renaissance in Italy. And I enjoyed this one so much. There's mystery and romance and so many great descriptions of food. I had a hard time putting it down. Thank you for that. Can you tell us a bit about the real chef that inspires the story?
Yeah, Bartolomeo Scappi. He was a celebrated chef that was in the Renaissance. He lived roughly 1500 to 1570, and he was a chef to several cardinals and to several popes. And he was somebody that was known throughout Italy. He published a cookbook that was it came out in 1570, and it was the best-selling cookbook for almost 200 years after it was published.
Wow.
We don't know much about his life, except for who he worked for. And, we know that this book had 1,000 recipes they left behind. And so I got to imagine what his life might have been like.
Well, you know, even just thinking about him publishing this cookbook hundreds of years ago, I thought that was even fascinating. Who was buying this cookbook at the time?
So it would have been bought primarily by nobility. Oftentimes these types of cookbooks were given as gifts. The noble class of Italy at this time really wanted to showcase their wealth by food. And so they would buy these cookbooks to give to their heads of household, to their chefs, to recreate these types of dinners in some way and to have this sort of, cuisine at their own tables. And then as the printing press became more prominent and books became less expensive, it was probably bought more often by people that weren't necessarily nobility, at least in the later part of its publication time.
And did you like stumble across the cookbook? Is that sort of how what led you to this subject, or how did you get inspired to write the book?
So when I was researching for my first novel, Feast of Sorrow, which is about the ancient Roman gourmand Apicius, I kept coming across Bartolomeo Scappi's name because there's not a lot known about Apicius in ancient Rome. There's just a few key things. And so he's often mentioned in a compendium of Italian culinary history. And so, of course, in those accounts, you'd see all sorts of names of different chefs throughout history. And Bartolomeo Scappi's name was one of the more prominent. And I decided I've got to check out this cookbook. So I went and got the cookbook. And there's one English translation by a British scholar named Terence Scully, who's a very well-known food historian. And I just thought, this is crazy. This book is so amazing. We know so little about Scappi. We know a couple of the names of his family members. We know that he dedicated the cookbook to his nephew and apprentice. And I just thought, this is so interesting. And so when I finished Feast of Sorrow, I was thinking, what's my next big thing? And I decided to give Bartolomeo a whirl.
Yeah, it's so fascinating. And I don't know if this is something that other readers would be thinking too, but I think I very much underestimated sort of the level of the cuisine at the time that it was. I mean, at least in these, he's cooking for the Pope. So obviously it's not what everyone was eating, but I just was amazed at how like elaborate some of these recipes were. Could you talk about, I guess, partly the food that's in his recipes and that he cooks, but I guess also too, how that was maybe a little bit different from what maybe everyday people in Rome were eating at the time?
Yeah, so at this point in time, there was a real shift in sophistication between the foods of the medieval ages and from that time frame to into the Renaissance. There was butter was starting to be used more commonly. You had table manners that actually started to come into play, and the idea of having a set way that you would do things. And that was on a level that just was very different than that of the Middle Ages. And the other big thing that was starting to happen is that the trade routes were increasing dramatically. And so the kinds of spices that you get in through the Venice ports were heightened. There was a lot more spice accessibility. You were starting to see foods from the New World. And so there was a great desire to experiment. And a lot of the nouveau riche that was starting to appear in the Renaissance also realized that a food was a great way to kind of showcase their style as well. So that there was a sense that just like there is today, the better the food that you could afford, therefore it was just a way to kind of show off how much wealth you had. Mm-hmm. And so some of the recipes are very complex in a way. There's more spices than ever before. Most recipes had coriander, cloves, cinnamon, nutmeg, might have ginger. Almost big chunks of the recipes have at least cinnamon, cloves, and nutmeg in them, which is interesting in a lot of cases, except in dishes that we're familiar with, like fried chicken. That becomes strange when we think of those spices in fried chicken. Yes. But they had pasta was starting to happen. There was tortellini and tortelloni. There was elaborate pies that were being made. There was a new sophistication around how meat was cooked. They would have, and there was also this sense of how you put the food on display. So if you cooked a peacock, you would also make it look like it was still alive. You'd put it back into its feathers before you served it. You would have a showmanship in the way that the food was displayed and in the way that the food was served and the way that the food was cut at the table as well. There was specialized meat carvers called trincianti, and they would carve up the meat in the air for you, and it would fall miraculously on your plate, and they would salt it very specially for you right there at the table. So,
oh, wow.
Yeah, they were really into show at this point.
What were some of the dishes that, is it Scappi? Is that how you say his name?
Yes.
Yeah. What were some of the dishes that Scappi made popular or that he was sort of known for?
I'm not entirely sure which ones he was known for, but I think definitely some of the pastas, you start to see some of the first turkey recipes in this cookbook. Interesting thing about turkey, is that it was starting to be brought over by Italian and Spanish explorers and Portuguese explorers, in the first part of the 1500s. But the nobility thought the birds were beautiful and they would give them away as gifts. And, Scappi discovered they were tasty. And so you have recipes for turkey pot pie. And it's the first European recipes we see for turkey. You also start to see more layered dishes. You have flaky pastries. There's actually a Napoleon recipe in there that's very similar to what we have today. Zabaglione, which is an egg custard dish that we're fairly familiar with in restaurants here in the States as well as overseas. And that was a dish actually that appears in Scappi's book for the sick. And it was a dish that, or sick or invalids or somebody that was recovering from something. And zabaglione was good for pregnant mothers so that they could be nourished. And so he had a variety of dishes for the sick, including barley gruel and chicken soup. And the chicken soup is very similar to what we understand to be today. And it was just There's literally like 1,000 recipes in the book. I could just talk about these recipes all day. There's so many amazing recipes, some that we would find wonderful to eat, others like hedgehog pie and roasted turtle and things like that we would not eat. But
yeah, I found that even when reading the book, some I was thinking, oh, I would love to have that, and others I was not quite so tempted by. And that was making me curious. Did you try some of the recipes that you included in the book or that you read in his cookbook?
Yes. That's some of the most fun that you can have when it comes to doing a book about food is tasting and trying these recipes. So I actually worked with several chefs and food historians and food bloggers on a companion cookbook that's free. And if you go to my website, crystalking.com, you can download this cookbook. And there's 27 recipes, I think, in it. There's even a recipe for a Renaissance inspired flavors for ice cream.
Which
they wouldn't have had ice cream. They might have had some shaved ice and taste and flavors that were sort of almost in the sorbetti range, but the recipes here are inspired by these dishes. And in some cases, for example, the ones in particular that my husband and I recreated, they're actually recreations from the cookbook itself. And so, some of those include like the fried chicken that I mentioned. There's actually a pumpkin cheesecake pie, which is one of the best pumpkin cheesecake pies I've ever made. So it's super delicious. Yeah.
That's so cool. Well, you know, one of the things I really loved about the book, in addition to sort of getting exposed to the food of the time, was just sort of getting immersed in the world of Renaissance Rome. And I have to say, I don't really feel like I knew much about everyday life then. And you do such a great job of sort of building out that world. And it got me curious how you went about your research for the book. And also, you know, I know we had, you know, Scoppi's recipes and a little bit about his life, but I guess even at the start of your research, how did you sort of approach how you would piece together the parts of his life that we know and sort of where to bring in the fiction?
So I started with the cookbook and really dug through it. It's a very readable book. There's a lot of really interesting things in it, including who he worked for. There's a really fantastic introduction that Terence Scully does to give some sense of the life and the world that Scoppi might have lived in. We know that his apprentice was named Giovanni and was his nephew. He had a sister. I also discovered information from about his will, and he had a sister named Caterina. Giovanni had a brother named Cesare. There was also a steward that the cookbook is also dedicated to, a man named Francesco Rianoso, who was in charge of the papal household, and he had to work very closely with Francesco. So between Francesco and Giovanni, these were two of the most important people in his life. So I had that information. And then there's no information about who he might have been in love with, or if he was married. There was no mention of children. And so I thought, well, what would have his life have been like? Did he love anyone? And then I thought, well, if he did, who would it have been? And why didn't they get mentioned? And so then I realized, well, what if he was married or in love with someone that he shouldn't have been? Maybe not married to, but... And so the idea kind of came into play that perhaps that's the case, that he loved someone he shouldn't have, and how he kept it secret. So the book, it begins, I'm not spoiling too much because you learn this very, very quickly, but it begins with Scoppi's he's just died, and his family is coming around him. His sister's there, and Giovanni is the one telling the story at this point. And Giovanni receives from Francesco Rianoso keys to a strong box, which he opens, of course, because why wouldn't you? Even though he had been instructed to burn the contents, and in it he finds the letters and journals of his uncle, and discovers that his uncle had a 50-year love affair with a noblewoman. And so from there, the story diverges and you have Skoppy in the past telling you the story of this woman who he calls Stella and the love that he had for her and what he did to protect that relationship. And then you have Giovanni in the future and the present in the book, telling you the story of how he's uncovering all the truths about this, this past of his uncle's. And so for me, I like to look at history as a whole in that time frame. So I look at who the important people in the world were. So people like Michelangelo and Benvenuto Cellini, and there's a code master named Giovanni Balasso. I think it's Giovanni. There's two code guys that wrote code in that time frame, and I get their names mixed up if I'm not looking at them. And there's different people that I thought these are really interesting individuals. Skoppy would have potentially known them. So, for example, he would have known Michelangelo, or at least fed him, because Michelangelo was working on the altar of the Sistine Chapel when Skoppy was working at the Vatican. So I like to take those things that we know about those people and the things occurring in the world. For example, there was a comet that appeared in 1577 in November, and it didn't go away until January of 1578. And I thought, that's so cool. I have a woman named Stella in my book, which means star in Italian. And so I'm going to move this comet around. I moved it upward about 8 months and used it as a frame for the book. And so I take the things we know and the things we don't know, and I just try to fill in all the gaps.
Well, one of the parts I thought was so interesting, because Skoppy is working at the Vatican, we're also sort of thrown into the world of the Catholic Church at that point in time. And in particular, I loved hearing about sort of the elaborate feasts that they would have, and but I guess also how with different popes came different attitudes about food and celebrations. Could you talk a little bit about sort of some of the real life, I guess, church history that you delved into to sort of set the scene for the book?
Yeah, it's very complex during this period of time. There were a number of popes that occurred in Skoppy's lifetime. And we learn a lot about what the papacy was like from his cookbook, actually. One of the things that he showcases in the book is the first depiction in print of a papal conclave and what happens when you have a pope that's died and they're electing a new one. He describes the entire funeral of how one of the popes, I think it was Pope Pius the I can't remember. There were so many popes in this time frame. I can't remember which pope he's describing in the book, but I think it's when Pope Pius IV was elected. And he's describing how the funeral occurs and the elaborate funeral that that takes place. And then he describes the Sistine Chapel when they're readying it for all these cardinals. And so at this time there were 70 cardinals. I think now there's around 500. So they wouldn't fit into the Sistine Chapel for this, but they would have their own cubicles with purple curtains that separated them all. And they would have one servant apiece. And he described like that they had a chamber pot and they had a jar that was that could lock for water so that you couldn't get poisoned by somebody. He describes the way that food was brought into the conclave in baskets and how it was inspected so that no notes could be passed to influence this election. And so the foods that went into the conclave would have had to been cut up. You couldn't have had pies that had a crust on the top. Anything that that a note or money or something could have been hidden in, they wouldn't have allowed into the conclave.
Oh, and you would put the food.
Yeah, they were very, because you couldn't talk to the outside world. You had to unanimously decide how a pope is elected. And they would put the baskets into a rotunda that turned so that they wouldn't actually even see the people when they were passing over the food. And the cool thing that I thought was really interesting, well, I mean, not cool, it's fascinating, I should say, is that during this time frame, when the cardinals had all of the luxuries of life for them in the Sistine Chapel, they sometimes took forever to make a decision, which was very dangerous for the world outside of it, to be a country without a leader. And riots would occur, and it was just mayhem outside. And so they needed to get this Pope elected as soon as possible. And so after this had occurred, and there was some Pope that took like 6 or 7 months to be elected, they decided to change the rules. And then what would happen is that the longer that the conclave was in this chapel, the more they would reduce the amount of the amount and the quality of food that you would receive.
Oh, interesting.
So you would have luxurious meals when you first got there, but if you were in there for more than a few weeks, it would start to dwindle, and pretty soon you were down to barley gruel. And so it was great incentive to hurry up and unanimously choose a Pope.
Yes, that would be a good motivator, I would think.
Yeah.
And then also at the time they would be having these like big elaborate feasts and things too. Could you tell us about that?
Yeah, the feasts were amazing. They could have multiple courses, sometimes up to as many as 10 courses. Each course would have 70 or 80 dishes, different kinds of foods at them. There's several menus in the cookbook that Scoppy describes. And one of them actually, this is a scene in my book, is one that was for the coronation dinner for, Pope Pius V. Pope Pius V, when he was elected, was really around the time that Scoppy decided to get serious about writing the cookbook. And it was likely because, Pius was a very pious Pope and he did not want to eat luxurious meals. So here's Scoppy at the height of all these banquets, these sugar sculptures that he would create, these foods that looked alive, these multiple courses. And he, in this cookbook, he describes a menu for, I think it's about 15 people, but there was 10 courses, 1,000 dishes, I think, over the course of many hours. And Pope Pius V gets wind of this coronation dinner, which had been tradition for centuries, that you, on the eve of, or on the day that of the anniversary of the Pope's election, you would have a big anniversary dinner. And he got wind of it and he canceled it. He was like, we're not having that. That's, you know, ostentatious. It goes against everything that we believe in and blah, blah, blah. But Scoppy was so angry about it that he actually included it in the cookbook as a menu and said,
oh, wow. This
was for a dinner that I was essentially not allowed to make.
So. Wow, that's very cool. Well, I'd love to hear a little bit about the writing of the book. I'm always fascinated by different writers' routines and processes. So I know you have one other historical fiction book. Have you always written historical fiction?
Well, the books are historical fiction, but I've written a lot of poetry before that, and I've been writing in the business world. And I really wanted to be a journalist when I first started out after college. But the books have tended to be historical fiction because I kind of came about it in a very funny way. I was writing a contemporary novel about a celebrity chef. And in this novel, the chef had a set of knives that had traveled through history. And I needed an origin story for the knives. And so I read a lot of food history and food memoirs, and I've just really been personally very interested in that. And I was reading a book by a man named Roy Strong, a food historian, and it's called Feast. And it's just about the history of banquets. And there's a line in there about how Apicius died. And so I thought, that's so nuts. I'm going to write a scene with this, and that'll be the origin story for the knives. And the scene is still in Feast of Sorrow, how Apicius acquires these knives and gives them to his chef. And, but I started writing that and I was like, this is so much more interesting. I'm going to just write this book instead. And so I started researching it, and I love research in general. That's just something I love, and have always loved. And so I just became obsessed with, the Italian world, actually the history, the people, the culture. I've been learning the language for over a decade, and there's so many of these culinary figures in Italy that no one really knows much about. And so I love the idea that I can kind of share that with the world.
Yeah, I love that, and just sort of getting to follow your curiosity and see where it leads. And with these books, so I'm just curious your writing routine. Are you someone who has to get up and get a certain number of words in, and sort of has a longer stretch where you're writing your book, or do you sort of do more of a sprint over a short period of time? What's your routine like?
Well, I have a day job, so I mostly write on weekends as a result of that. Mm-hmm. And usually in spurts, I will get real gung-ho for a few months. And I have a writing group that I meet with every 2 weeks, which has been immensely helpful to make sure that I stay on track. And we've been meeting for, I think, 12 years, maybe. And so that's been super helpful. When I have the time, I can actually write pretty quickly and pretty easily. I wrote most of The Chef's Secret in the space of 3 or 4 months when I was in between jobs, and I just cranked it out. So I know that I have the ability to just sit down and really spit stuff out. Mm-hmm. But I don't have that kind of time, unfortunately, in my my normal life. So I mostly write on weekends and in stolen moments.
Well, I noticed it stuck out to me because I know you're in the Boston area and I am too. And I noticed the dedication of the book was to Grub Street. And you said in it, for Grub Street, you opened a door into a new world for me. Was that through taking classes, or I think you've taught there too, right?
Yeah, they actually really changed my life, literally. I had met Michelle Toth, who was one of the board of directors long ago. She was on the board of directors for many years, and she no longer lives in Boston at the moment. But she's somebody I met at a conference about a David Allen conference on getting things done. And I said, oh, I've heard about Grove Street. It sounds amazing. And this was early in the days of Grove Street. Probably they had been around for maybe 5 or 6 years at best. And I said, oh, they sound really interesting, but I can't afford the price at the time. And because I was pretty new and young. And she said, well, get a hold of me, and you know, it would be great. I can put you in touch with them, that kind of thing. And so we never actually got that done. We didn't really end up talking with each other, but I went to the Muse, and she was speaking, and I went up to her afterwards and I said, you know, I don't know if you remember me, the Muse and the Marketplace is their big writing conference. And she said, I do remember you. We didn't get that done. And so, she introduced me to Christopher Castellani, who is, the artistic director. And I told him about a book of writing exercises I had been doing for my master's, where I took business and science sector exercises for brainstorming, and I transformed them for writers. And when I was shopping it around, agents all said, this sounds great, but nobody knows who you are. You need to write a book, or you need to teach, or you need to do something different. So I explained this to Christopher, and he said, oh, you can teach at Grub Street. And so I started teaching at Grub Street, and that gave me the opportunity to take classes, because as a teacher, I could take them for free. And so I taught my exercises. I took classes on the first few classes, and then when I can afford them, I began to pay for them. And I workshopped my first novel there. I met my writing group there.
Wow.
I met my agent through Grub Street at one of the Muse and Marketplace events. And they just literally transformed everything for me and reshaped my life. And so I owe them an incredible debt of gratitude.
Well, that's amazing. And now I'm actually even more excited. Well, I had seen your presenter. I'm actually also going to Muse in the Marketplace. Well, I'm going for the first time this year.
Oh, you will love it.
I'm so excited. And I saw that you're presenting, and then saw the dedication too. But yeah, I've been looking at Grub Street for a long time, and would like to get more involved. So that's so cool that it had such a big impact on your writing career. Well, I always love to end by asking authors and any guests really what they've been reading lately. Is there a book that you would want to recommend to listeners?
I've been reading a lot of advanced reader copies of books that aren't out yet. So, and so when I get this question, it's like, oh, well, I just read this book, but you can't read it for 4 months.
It's so okay. This probably won't go up for a couple months anyway, so maybe it'll even out.
So I think that, I've read many books recently. I'm a voracious reader. My goal this year is to read 110 books before the end of the year. And that's in all my stolen moments. And one of the books that I've read this year that I really, really loved is The Stationery Shop, by Marjan Kamali. And she's also a Boston area author. And it's about this couple, in Iran in the 50s. And they fall in love and their love was thwarted and they reconnect 60 years later. And it is just this gorgeous, beautiful book right when Iran was starting to be very war torn. And, I can't say enough gorgeous things about this book. It's beautiful. And it has a gorgeous cover. It's got beautiful flowers on the front of it. And it takes place in a stationery shop, which is also kind of a bookshop. And so I'm not entirely sure when it comes out. Oh, it comes out in June.
Oh, okay.
It comes out in June because I remember it comes out around my birthday.
Wonderful. Well, that sounds great. I'm adding that to my list and I will link to it in the show notes. If listeners want to check that out. And Crystal, if people want to find out more about you and your books, and also to get to check out the companion cookbook, where should they head?
So crystalking.com is the that's my website, and you can get a copy of the cookbook, both for Feast of Sorrow and for The Chef's Secret. And there's links to where all sorts of places you can buy the book. And all the places you can follow me in social media and my blog is there as well.
Wonderful. Well, I just love The Chef's Secret and I know that listeners will too. So thank you for chatting more about it with us and just for making the time.
Thank you so much for having me.
I hope you head to your local library or bookstore to pick up your own copy of The Chef's Secret. To learn more about Crystal King, you can visit her website, crystalking.com, and there you'll also find links to follow her on social media. If you're enjoying the podcast, please be sure to take a moment to subscribe and review. I would so appreciate it. And for links to all of the books mentioned on this week's episode, including The Chef's Secret, you can visit the show notes at abookishhome.com. Thanks for listening and happy readings.